welcome everybody to this week's reading of the Independent Indie Week. That's brought to you from the North Carolina Reading Service for an audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. And this week's issue dated April the 12th of 2024, and I'm John Feddersen here to read it to you. In no particular reading order, a couple of articles from Durham and Chapel Hill City Councils. First, the Durham City Council is enforcing its rules of decorum in ways that it was not before. March 18th was poised to be a busy night. At Durham City Hall, the council was holding its first public hearing for the fiscal year budget. The issue of public worker wages dominated the conversation during elections last fall. Then this was an opportunity for residents to make their concerns known. But another issue resurfaced that evening. With the chamber and lobby seating full, residents who tried to enter the building after 7 p.m. were allegedly locked out for hours. Councilmember Didriana Freeman raised that concern to council on behalf of residents at the end of the budget hearing, spurring a brief but contentious back and forth with Mayor Leonardo Williams. Williams touched on the issue briefly before that meeting adjourned. Quote, "For the record, we do not just kick people out or lock people out, but I will choose safety. This mayor is going to follow these procedures that are set in place, and once we get to capacity, the building will be held until there's more available capacity inside, and that has been clearly communicated." And at the work session the following Thursday, he reiterated that position. "I want to make sure we're consistent on what time we open the doors to make sure folks can be able to get in here, have enough time to get to the clerk's desk to sign up to speak. But once the meeting starts, we are now handling the business of the people. It will not be a free-for-all. I just won't tolerate it. I don't want it to put us in a position to be sued either." In recent months, an unusually large number of residents have shown up to city council meetings to rally around galvanizing issues such as the ceasefire resolution in Gaza, shot spotter, and city worker wages. After hundreds of protesters took over City Hall at a meeting in February, administrators started cracking down on excess people allowed into the building and more strictly adhering to the fire code. The changes left some residents on the outside looking in with little explanation as to what the rules are for accessing public meetings. They question whether those rules actually were clearly communicated, as Mayor Williams stated. On February 5th, nearly 4 months after the conflict between Israel and Hamas erupted, hundreds of Durham residents draped in keffiyehs and carrying roses flooded City Hall to pressure the council members to sign a ceasefire resolution. Every seat in the city chamber was filled. A sea of protesters spilled into the hallway. Residents looked on through the glass doors as the council proceeded with its regularly scheduled meetings, encountering little resistance from city staff or security when entering the building. 48 minutes later, the meeting came to a halt as protesters stood up and began singing in unison. A squad of Durham police entered the chambers and formed a barrier at the head of the dais. Yelling and arguing between factions in the audience interrupted the singing and chanting intermittently. The protest continued for 20 minutes before folks started leaving. After a short recess, the city council proceeded with city business, though an emotional charge lingered in the chamber. Demonstrators returned on February 19th for the council's formal vote on the Gaza ceasefire resolution. The evening air was frigid. Hundreds of residents huddled up in line outside the entrance to the building, expecting to flood into City Hall as they had 2 weeks prior, but the procedure had changed. Officers at the front desk ushered them through the security check one at a time. A few chairs were set up in front of the monitors in the lobby to accommodate overflow from the chamber. Once the chamber seats and lobby chairs were filled, no one else was allowed in. Durham resident Charlotte Rios said, "This felt unexpected for us. because the first time we were able to enter and people were able to sit on the floor or sit in other areas of the lobby and watch what was happening on the screens. Rios says the officers at the front desk handed out flyers to those who didn't make it inside with instructions on how to watch the meetings virtually. But viewing the meeting wasn't their only mission. It was about power in numbers. Rios says we had maybe 150 to 200 people outside at the start of the meeting. It was unusually cold, and people had other things to do, so they started leaving. Those who persevered were blocked from entering the building with little understanding of why, according to multiple sources. At times, the doors to the building were physically locked to prevent people from slipping in behind those who were leaving. A security officer scrambled back and forth from the front desk to the chamber to keep an updated count of the number of available seats. As the night waned on and the temperature dropped, tensions rose. Eventually, the remaining residents were allowed into the building around 11 p.m. after attendees who gave their public comments started to trickle out, and the council voted to adopt a ceasefire resolution close to 1 a.m. Rios says the lack of communication from city officials about how they are administrating the rules and procedures has been frustrating for residents. Quote, it's inconsistent. When we were all allowed to be in there, I would say easily 200 people were in the lobby, watching online, standing outside of the chambers. We were able to do that one day, and then the next time there's a limited number of seats. The process is much slower. It's hard not to wonder what the reasons for that are unless they're communicated very clearly to us, and it feels like they were not. During a typical Monday night City Council meeting, attendees mostly consist of city staff, land use lawyers, developers and property owners, and a handful of neighbors opposing new construction. Ceremonial items, which are recognized at the start of each meeting, can attract anywhere from 10 to 100 additional attendees. Rios says she questions why the overflow rule isn't applied to ceremonial items and other types of events with high attendance, saying the rule should apply to every single issue, organization, and person across the board. So that means moving forward, these are the rules for every event, regardless if it's a city council meeting or citywide event, a function like a party, or other events they have in that building. If there's concern about the number of people, then that should apply to everything that happens in that building. If that's not the case, then why would it just apply in one or two circumstances? Issues such as the ceasefire resolution have attracted an uptick in meeting participation, making seating on these nights more scarce. Some residents attend the meetings to speak on certain agenda items. Others attend as a show of solidarity. Bo Ferguson, one of the City of Durham's deputy managers, says city staffers do their best to accommodate residents who want to engage during meetings, but they have to balance attendance with public safety. Quote, all our efforts are centered around facilitating access to our public meetings via in-person or virtual. If it's in someone's intent to watch or participate, we strive to make that as convenient, as equitable as possible. It's also our obligation to make those meetings safe, and capping attendance at the room and lobby's seating capacity is a responsibility we take seriously. Ferguson says he understands that it's frustrating for people who want to enter council chambers after its capacity, but since they have the option to watch meetings online or on Zoom, quote, we believe that's a reasonable option once our spaces are filled up. The stark difference in procedure from February 5 and 19 caught many residents by surprise. Attorney Elizabeth Simpson has been a Durham resident since 2010. She's participated in other public demonstrations in the past and likens the recent activism at City Hall to previous demonstrations over national issues like Occupy Wall Street, the response to the murder of George Floyd, and local matters related to the expansion of the HART program and the city budget. Simpson says the recent crackdown on meeting attendance is abnormal. Quote, Durham has set a precedent over a large number of years that if the chambers are full, there is overflow in the lobby. That's what the public has come to expect as part of the accommodation for access in person. Once you open it up to the public and create this expectation that this is part of the accommodation for an open meeting, they need to continue doing that unless they have a really good justification. Council member Javier Caballero says the confusion about public meeting procedures comes from a lack of consistency with how the rules have been administered, dating back to when Steve Shule was the mayor. Quote, a lot of the breakdown on council previously was people not following procedures. But also, procedures were outdated, and so you can't criticize somebody for not following procedures when they haven't been updated, and people haven't been following them, period. Now, Caballero is the chair of the city's Procedures Committee, which includes Councilmember Carl Rist, Mayor Pro Tem Mark Anthony Middleton, and Mayor Williams. She says the committee is working to codify rules around issues like managing public comments via Zoom and update rules around a meeting decorum in an effort to offer clarity and consistency for residents who want to engage with the process. Caballero says Leo Williams is being really firm on procedure because he was also on a council that lacked that. We had people shouting things from the walkway or shouting from the chamber. We had people naming staff members by name and saying things about them, and that's not okay. For Rios, Simpson, and others, the inconsistency of the rules and lack of clarification from the council can seem like retaliation toward residents with certain social and political beliefs. Residents in support of a permanent ceasefire in Gaza, for instance. Simpson says, if you're letting in people who are there for a zoning matter, you're letting in people who are wearing Israeli flags, for instance, and giving them escorts, but you're locking out other members of the public who you perceive as having a different political view, and there are seats available, that's viewpoint discrimination, and you cannot do that under the First Amendment. At the heart of the issue is a lack of communication between security staff at the entrance to City Hall, the staff who manage the building, and city council members who are charged with relaying information to the public from the dais. Without that communication, residents are left to judge for themselves whether they can engage in the democratic process. Rios says it's important for council, because there are elected representatives of the constituents of Durham, to make sure they're communicating very clearly to everyone about what the rules and limitations are. When you do have those inconsistencies, that's where you have to wonder what's not said. It's hard not to feel like they're trying to keep us out of City Hall. That's difficult to hear or see happen in a place where it feels like all Durham residents should be welcomed. Okay, from Durham, and now Chapel Hill's Town Council is trying to decide what they should do with the town's many volunteer advisory boards. Now, there's been a lot of comments and changes in this in Wake County, Raleigh City Council. Let's see what Chapel Hill has to say and think. At a September work session, Susan Brown, Director of Strategic Communications for the Town of Chapel Hill, estimated that the town staff spends about $10,000 worth of time each month preparing materials for the town's boards, even though it's not clear what purpose many of the boards serve. I'm sorry, interrupted Town Council Member Paris Miller-Fouché. Did you say $10,000? Now, Chapel Hill's council members are deciding if the volunteer advisory boards add value to the town's government, or if the boards and commissioners are irredeemable, resource-sucking pits of obsolescence. While mostly everyone in the town government recognizes problems with the current structure, no one's quite sure how to fix them. What is an advisory board? Most municipalities have some form of citizen advisory boards. In Chapel Hill, the roughly 20 bodies are pitched as forums for citizens to to participate in government voluntarily by giving feedback to the town on specific topics, from development design to stormwater management utility, without them having to run for office. Anyone who lives in the town can apply to serve on a board, and council members vote to appoint the members. Chapel Hill, like most small municipalities, uses a council manager form of government. It operates a lot like a business. The council, elected by the people, is like a board of trustees, and the mayor is the chair. The council appoints a town manager, who serves as a non-political CEO of the town. Because the manager is responsible for hiring and firing town staff, that staff is relatively insulated from the politics of the town council. If shareholders, that is, voters, aren't getting the return on investment that they want, they can vote out the council and mayor, but cannot, say, directly fire the director of transit. Part of the board's problem and commissions is they don't clearly fit into that structure. Then council member and current mayor Jess Anderson said in November, "I am, to this day, not totally clear what the delineation is between the Stormwater Management Utility Advisory Board and the stormwater staff. In certain situations, boards have helped fill gaps that the town staff apparatus needed more time to address." Brown cited the Justice in Action Committee as an example. The committee was created in the early 2000s, originally to provide recommendations on renaming Martin Luther King Boulevard, then called Airport Road. After that, it shifted its focus to, quote, "the substantive issues of race, economics, social justice, and power." But a lot has changed in the town since then. Brown says, "We have a DEI office. We have a language justice plan and numerous other large and small-scale efforts around racial, economic, and social justice. And in recent years, the committee has struggled with finding a clear charge and meaningful meeting content." So, at the end of 2023, the council decided to dissolve that committee. Some other committees may be getting the axe too, although staff prefer to use the more diplomatic verb sunset. Why are boards on the agenda now? Last year, the council asked the staff to look at the effectiveness of the boards. At several recent meetings, staff members have come back with a series of evaluations, noting that many boards lack a clear purpose or often don't even have the quorum necessary to make decisions. Brown and her team have provided recommendations, including delineating board missions, introducing training for members, and standardizing board sizes, schedules, and scope. Brown used the Library Advisory Board, formerly known as the Library Board of Trustees, as an example of a successful change. Quote, "Some members thought that it had a governance, fiduciary, or oversight role. Others thought of it more as a volunteer nonprofit board that conceived of programs and services. Because of these different understanding of roles and charges, there was a lot of frustration and confusion." Miller Fouché pushed for a more aggressive reevaluation, saying, "I don't want to be married to boards and commissions for the sake of being married to boards and commissions." The council members are familiar with the intricacies of boards because nearly all of them served on boards before they ran for council. In recent years, especially, candidates have pointed to that experience as an authentic demonstration of interest in town government. Council member Camille Berry, who didn't previously serve on a town board, questioned that experience as a credential. Quote, "We have folks in the media saying, here are your candidates, but they have served on an advisory board. I did not," Berry said, "but I certainly served this community." Who serves on boards? To some council members, board membership is part of the problem. In Chapel Hill especially, many of the most politically involved folks are old white homeowners. It's hard to imagine a lower-income full-time worker choosing to attend a 6 p.m. board meeting, especially if they have kids at home. The town has made some real efforts. In 2018, the council approved funds for child care and transportation assistance in an attempt to increase diversity, but there is still a lot of work ahead. Councilmember Karen Stegman said in November, "Our boards don't work for our diverse community. They're not the right way to get community input. We need to find another way to get that input and not pretend that's what boards are." The staff and council have also started looking at the application process. Brown said in March, "The current process is not intuitive or easy to use. The current process carries a fairly high administrative burden for staff, and the current application and appointment processes were not designed to create a diverse field of candidates." A final segment of this article, how can the council and boards shift to a policy focus? With the ongoing process of rewriting the town's land use management ordinance, the council has been trying to reorient its focus to policy. Council members hope to bring that vision to any future iterations of boards as well. Mayor Anderson says, 2024 has been the year of trying to figure out how we get into that policy lane and really stay there. But that reorientation may take a lot of legwork. Former council member Tai Huing, speaking in his last month on the board, was perhaps the most candid in his assessment, saying, "The outcome that I really wanted from the boards was them gone." His own experience on the housing board, even the deep dive discussion that the housing board had, I don't think ever really made it to council. At the end of the day, we didn't really know what we were talking about. The conversation at the council table has been generally amiable. It's not exactly a nuclear topic, but staff cannot make much change without the blessing of the 9 council members, who all seem to have slightly different priorities. Brown said to the council, "I'm trying to get you all to tell us what you want so we can try and bring it back to you." In March, the council agreed to discuss the issue further at a later work session. Okay, now to a longer article concerned almost completely on artificial intelligence. As it upends the media landscape, UNC professors and journalists grapple with how to teach and apply it. UNC Chapel Hill's Carroll Hall sits just off the main quad and is home to the Hussman School of Journalism and Media. 12 granite steps lead up to its shallow east-facing portico, shaded by a pediment held aloft by 6 iconic columns, a nod to the Greeks. On this sunny spring day, the building's would-be journalists are away, out for spring break. On one side of the lobby, the words of the First Amendment are carved into the wall. On the other is the Hussman Credo, which reads in part, "The pursuit of truth is a noble goal of journalism, but the truth is not always apparent or known immediately." You can say that again. Given the advances in generative artificial intelligence, AI, and its rapid deployment across the media landscape, this doesn't seem likely to change anytime soon. For those charged with teaching the craft of journalism, the question is how to help the next generation of reporters manage through this seismic shift in technology, consistent with their historical role of trying to give readers, listeners, and viewers the information they need to parse out the truth. To understand how educators are tackling this, the Indy spoke with several prominent journalists, including Hussman Dean Paul Reese, about how AI impacts the teaching and practice of the profession. "The application of AI has broad implications, especially in this year's presidential election and going forward, the role of reporters in supplying facts and sussing out misinformation and disinformation remains as crucial as ever." introduced by OpenAI in November 2022, the generative AI-driven chatbot box, ChatGPT, quickly became the fastest-growing consumer application in history, according to an investment firm, UBS. But what exactly is meant by generative AI? Put that query to ChatGPT, and here's what you get. Quote, generative AI refers to a class of artificial intelligence techniques that are designed to generate new data or content that resembles and often expands upon the patterns and characteristics of existing data. These systems learn from a data set and can create new instances of data that are similar to the examples they were trained on. Specialized processors, better algorithms, and access to massive data sets are among the developments that make all this possible. Its impact is being felt everywhere. To again cite the chatbot, it has shown promising results in creating realistic images, generating human-like text, synthesizing music, and much more. However, it also raises ethical concerns, particularly regarding the potential for generating misleading or harmful content, as well as issues related to intellectual property and privacy. Hussmann's Rice was named dean in July 2022, 4 short months before ChatGPT burst on the scene. Prior to joining UNC, Rice had spent 6 years as dean of the School of Communication at Emerson College in Boston, and before that, dean of the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at Florida International in Miami. He's worked as a reporter in both U.S. and Brazilian news organizations. He says, since I became an academic, it's been a nonstop train of emerging technologies. He places AI in the continuum of other new technologies that have disrupted the profession over the years, different in scale, possibly, but not in type. He says of the school's role in helping manage this transition, I think we at Hussmann can take a leadership position in the way AI is adopted. We want to be part of the process of determining what is the future of the industry and how the industry is disrupted. He points out that the UNC's journalism school has a long history of innovation in data-driven journalism, pioneered by the recently deceased Phil Mayer, who has been called the father of computer-assisted reporting. To that end, Rice anticipates working closely with other schools within UNC, including the data science and business schools. In considering how AI might play out in the classroom, Rice offers nothing revolutionary, but rather is inclined to emphasize the basics. He says, we teach critical thinking, not only data gathering, but how do you process that data? How do you separate truth from hallucinations, i.e., incorrect predictions resulting from the use of incomplete or biased data? That last major disruptor, the Internet, laid waste to a broad swath of the journalism profession, and newsrooms around the world continue to feel its impact. What was true in the pre-internet age is even more true in the time of AI, as misinformation is spread across a growing range of news and social media platforms, burying facts under an avalanche of data-driven deepfakes, further undermining trust in an industry whose credibility is already at or near an all-time low, according to research from Gallup. In this context, AI is seen simultaneously as both a powerful tool and an existential threat. That dichotomy was captured in a recent internal memo to employees from Matthias Döpfner, the CEO of a German publisher, Axel Springer, which owns Politico, among other outlets. Artificial intelligence, Döpfner wrote, has the potential to make independent journalism better than it ever was, or simply replace it. Shannon McGregor, an associate professor at Hussman and principal investigator with the Center for Information, Technology, and Public Life, holds a less Manichaean view, saying it's another technology, but because it's so new, we tend to get this great excitement and also this moral panic. This is a cycle we tend to get over and over again. It's the great hope, but also it's going to ruin everything. Like many other technologies, most of the time it's going to be used in pretty benign ways, but there will be always the outlier cases that can have these huge impacts. Former Hussman professor Chris Rausch, who recently stepped down from his role as dean of the School of Communications at Quinnipiac University to return to practicing journalism, says that in one sense, quote, everybody becomes an editor for AI when it's used as a research tool. This can be good or bad. On the bad side, reporters can become increasingly dependent on less than transparent technology to source the facts of a story, or with generative AI to create the story itself. But AI can also be useful, summarizing lengthy documents, analyzing historical data, and writing reports, for example. Rausch says if AI can write basic stories, it frees journalists up for longer, more analytical pieces that are more important to society. Transparency is clearly an important issue, as is disclosure. But transparency in the sense that a reader understands the process through which AI derives a result isn't really possible in many instances. Disclosure, too, has its own set of challenges. McGregor questions how journalists can gauge the level of disclosure they should use when they have employed some type of AI. She says a lot of that is an open question. On the one hand, you could say that disclosure in any use case makes sense. But I don't disclose when I've used, say, the grammar editor on Microsoft Word. Everyone is worried. This year's focal point for those worried about disinformation and misinformation is likely to be the U.S. presidential election, but the issue is one of global concern. In a survey conducted at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, in January, attendees agreed, quote, false or wrong information poses the biggest danger to the world in the next 2 years. This is according to a story in Bloomberg. This beat out other perennial worries like extreme weather and involuntary migration. At Bloomberg, says Matthew Winkler, who co-founded Bloomberg News in 1990, at Bloomberg, AI is probably the most anticipated and discussed subject, and that's not going to change. UNC Hussman has partnered with Bloomberg since 2017 to give students from diverse backgrounds the opportunity to learn the fundamentals of journalism. There's general agreement that adhering to what has traditionally been considered best practices will go a long way toward inoculating the industry against potential AI-driven mischief. Winkler says, if you obey best practices, you're aware of how your reporting can go awry. Is it transparent? Do I trust this data? How do I know it's true? McGregor says journalists have to pay attention to second sourcing and verification when there's the potential that things have been manipulated. McGregor notes this will be particularly important around breaking news, where there is intense time pressure and supercharged issues. As in other areas, AI can cut both ways, making it easier to facts check in some instances, for example, while in others AI makes it harder to discover the provenance of things. Born in Indiana, the ability to sort through massive amounts of data to identify patterns, and through these patterns some kind of useful knowledge, is the defining feature of basic AI. Generative AI takes this a step further, creating new content by learning from the data. Almost by definition, these tasks aren't replicable by humans in any practical time frame. The data sets are too big. There's an old saying in the technology industry that, quote, software is its own proof. In other words, if it works, it works. But no code or algorithm can fully anticipate every circumstance in which it might find itself. That lack of traceable attribution can be a problem, as anyone who has seen those videos of automated cars driving into a dead-end street over and over again can attest. ChatGPT, says Winkler, of an exercise in which he asked the algorithm to perform what should have been a simple fact, pulling up his own bio. It continues to insist, "I was born in Indiana." He was born in New York City. So if you're a journalist and you think AI is going to do your work for you, forget about it. AI cannot replace the journalist if we care about things that matter. Presumably, Chat will eventually discover where the Bloomberg News co-founder was born, but Winkler makes a larger point about how the profession needs to be taught in the world of AI. He says, journalism schools have a big role to play in teaching the people who are going to lead our profession that one thing has never gone out of style is the need to verify whatever you report before you share it. If it's unique, it can't possibly be taken at face value until we know why it's unique. When something is 3 or 4 standard deviations from normal, and there hasn't been some biblical event, it has to be treated with great care and suspicion. Next section. First, let's fire all the reporters. In this world, the journalist remains an indispensable actor. But if reporters are more needed than ever, you wouldn't know it from recent news coming out of the industry. January of this year saw massive layoffs, with more than 500 journalists losing their jobs, according to a report from Challenger, Gray, and Christmas, an employment consulting firm. Some of this reflects the continued impact of the Internet on business models, but the rapid adoption of AI across newsrooms is almost certainly a factor as well. Journalism AI, that's a global initiative from the London School of Economics think tank Polis, that's supported by Google News Initiative. Journalism AI recently surveyed more than 120 editors, journalists, technologists, and media makers from 105 large and small newspapers around the world on their use of AI. In its report on the research, the organization describes the growth as explosive. 85% of the survey's respondents indicated they have experimented with generative AI technologies to author content and better interact with audiences, among other applications. More than 80% expected the use of AI to expand over the near term. Current uses included news gathering, 75%, news production, 90%, and news distribution, 80%. As to generative AI, those polled cite potential uses that include exploring new angles and perspectives that had not been considered before, generating hypotheses and scenarios that had not been previously considered, and creating more personalized content for readers. One survey respondent said, generative AI can enhance our skills and values and empower us to produce more relevant and impactful stories in ways that we can't even imagine. Of course, one individual's personalized content is another's news silo, so there are potential downsides as well. 60% of those surveyed expressed concern about, quote, ethical implications of AI integration for editorial quality and other aspects of journalism, including values like accuracy, fairness, and transparency. Debiasing, which goes to the sourcing of data by AI, as well as the algorithms that underlie the technology, was cited as a major worry. There was also this, the concern that generative AI has made possible, quote, production and distribution of disinformation at a scale we haven't seen before, coupled with the inability to cross-check a wholly manufactured story. Another survey respondent, AI-generated content is trickier to debunk because there's no reference material to cross-check it with. It's completely a work of fiction, as opposed to a photo that has been manipulated. With this kind of disinformation, you at least have an original photo with which to compare the false version. Better, deeper fakes, in other words. Finally, a critical role. Responsible public interest journalism plays a critical role in the health of society. If the Journalism AI survey is any indication, those in the industry believe it will continue to evolve and survive, and that its uniquely human qualities will allow it to find a way to coexist with the increasingly human-like intelligence of generative AI and whatever comes next. The survey concludes, news organizations have shown remarkable resilience and innovation in sustaining and sometimes thriving, despite the challenges they have faced. It might even be that in a world where Gen AI is such a power for ill as well as good, public interest journalism will be more important than ever. Winkler, for one, maintains his faith in the role that journalists have to play. Quote, if you're interested in the pursuit of truth, AI is not going to get you there today, tomorrow, or anytime soon, he said. But of course, not everyone is interested in the pursuit of truth. The next story published online at the UNC Media Hub and reprinted in Indy. Harm reduction organizations around the triangle are working to prevent overdoses. After Bella Grumet, a UNC Chapel Hill senior majoring in neuroscience, lost a close friend to an overdose last year, she was motivated to become an advocate for harm reduction strategies in hopes of preventing more drug-related deaths among college students. Her friend was Elizabeth Burton, a student who passed away last month in a Duke University dorm room with a mixture of alcohol, cocaine, and fentanyl in her system. The 19-year-old was an honors student, a Carolina Blue Scholar, and a recently elected director of sisterhood in her sorority, Zeta Tau Alpha, before her death. She was an assured admit to the Kenan Flagler Business School. Burton is one of many who have died from accidental overdose in the past year. According to the Center for Disease Control, 51,000 people died due to unintentional drug overdose in 2022. 51,000. 64% had at least one potential opportunity for prevention. The United States Attorney's Office for the Middle District of North Carolina announced February 28th that Cy Fraser, 44, was sentenced to 29 years in federal prison and Carlissa Allen, 46, to 28 years for drug trafficking. Both dealers marketed themselves to college students as a source of narcotics, primarily cocaine, and knowingly distributed fentanyl, according to the sentencing announcement. They were linked to the deaths of Burton and Joshua Zinner, another young person who overdosed a day after Burton's death. But Grumet, G-R-U-M-E-T, believes the outcome of Burton's overdose could have been different. She says, what struck me about the stories, once they came out, is that there were so many opportunities for both bystanders and some of medical personnel involved who could have administered naloxone and could have saved her life. Grumet is a member of the Carolina Harm Reduction Unit, an organization at UNC whose mission is to educate students and campus organizations on how to properly administer naloxone, a medication used to rapidly reverse an opioid overdose. Since naloxone binds to opioid receptors, it reverses and blocks the effects of heroin, morphine, fentanyl, and oxycodone. This makes it a highly effective temporary treatment in the event of an accidental overdose, but because its effects don't last long, it's critical to obtain medical intervention as soon as possible after receiving the medicine. Naloxone has no effect on a person who does not have opioids in their system, meaning there are no consequences if it's used incorrectly. But it can cause withdrawal symptoms, which are important to watch out for. The Carolina Harm Reduction Union teaches this information to students. They found that generally young people are taught to maintain abstinence from drugs and alcohol while growing up, which often makes education about those subjects taboo. But Carolyn Klodfelter, a co-founder of Carolina Harm Reduction Unit, said realistically, alcohol and drug use is bound to happen. Teaching harm reduction, which lessens the negative social and physical consequence of substance use, is a better approach toward preventing deaths. Andrea Desmarais, a research program leader in the Duke University Population Health Sciences Department, says there is countless research showing that the strategy works. Desmarais works with Duke's Harm Reduction Research Collaboratory, which develops drug use interventions with harm reduction in mind, saying there's funding at the National Institute of Health level to look more into how to implement harm reduction interventions and that sort of thing. So yeah, this is a very evidence-based approach. There are many benefits of harm reduction, most notably a reduction of stigma toward people who use illegal drugs, Desmarais notes. The practice paints people who struggle from substance use disorders as ordinary humans who need help and compassion. This increases their sense of accountability, teaches them how to help themselves through temptations, and reduces their risk of harming themselves or others. Klodfelter says she gets frustrated watching the public fight over who is responsible for deaths such as Burton's, or whether universities should be more transparent about overdoses that occur on their campuses, saying, how could her death not mean we need to change? How is it okay to sit here and say, let's just keep telling people not to use? Organizations around the triangle are working to implement harm reduction in the state. I think one of the biggest foundations of our collaboratory is the underlying philosophy, it's not our job to stop people from using drugs, says Hillary Chen, research coordinator in the Duke Population Health Department. It's our job to try to support people in accessing the resources they need to be safe while they make whatever choices they want in their lives. Through Remedy Alliance for the People, an organization that ensures harm reduction programs have access to naloxone, the Carolina Harm Reduction Union is able to give out naloxone to students for free with step-by-step usage instructions. The union also provides fentanyl testing strips, allowing students to determine whether their drugs are safe. According to the Centers for Disease Control, many drugs might be mixed with deadly levels of fentanyl and you wouldn't be able to see, taste, or smell it. It's nearly impossible to tell if drugs have been laced with fentanyl unless a person uses testing strips. I'm going to interject here that this article, if you went to Indie Week online, there is a chart, a graphic chart, which I can't describe to you now, which shows the proper steps of identifying and administering naloxone. So that's worth checking that out on its own level. Anyway, Greek life organizations at UNC have also started providing life-saving amenities. Cameron Somerville, who served as UNC's Panhellenic president from 2022 to 23, said she played a large role in distributing Narcan, a type of naloxone administered through nasal spray, to every sorority house at the university. She says, "I just think it's better to always be prepared, and if naloxone has no side effects, then to me there's no harm in distributing it." Gourmet notes that that medication should be a priority. She says she's watched a person's condition improve dramatically after receiving naloxone. Still, harm reduction strategies themselves aren't always enough. A doctor's belief in the acceptability of harm reduction is also crucial to its use in a medical setting, according to a 2010 study by psychologists at University of Washington. For example, a therapist's consideration of harm reduction doesn't mean they don't see issues with their patient's drug use. The study said, "It means the therapist can see their client's situation in more than black and white, all or nothing terms." Gourmet also believes a student-to-student approach works best for young adults. She said students have been told they're less afraid of being snitched on because they're talking to someone their age. She said, "I feel like sometimes when it comes from an authority figure, people feel like their choices are being judged and are less inclined to ask questions or engage with the material if it's being forced on them." But Gourmet says she has no judgment. And Chen from Duke Collaboratory agrees, saying, "We don't think there's one prescribed way to tell someone to live their life. We think it's just really important for people to have those resources to be safe." The next article has as its subject Jennifer MacArthur, who's director of a new documentary titled Family Tree. And it looks as if this will be shown as part of, or was shown, the debut on Friday at Full Frame Documentary Festival. That was April 5th, just a few days ago. This new documentary takes us into the world of sustainable forestry through the lens of two black families in rural North Carolina during pivotal moments in their business and family history. Black land ownership has dwindled since the beginning of the 20th century, and Family Tree examines the ways that creating multi-generational economic and ecological sustainability for families, requires deepening familial ties and creating a strong foundation of trust. Jennifer MacArthur, the film's director, brings audiences inside intimate moments between two families, Jeffries and Williams, while detailing the burden that land theft has on black families and the planet. In doing so, it strikes a compelling balance between a call to action to protect our climate future and a reflection on the importance of a human connection, two things that are also deeply personal to MacArthur. And now this article is in terms of a question and answer interview. What motivated you to make Family Tree? MacArthur says, "I was going through my own reconnection with nature. I grew up in the country outside of New York City, but when I was a teenager, we moved to Alaska. This was in the 90s. There weren't things like satellite television. It was very remote and rural, even in Anchorage. When I left Alaska, I moved to New York, where I lived for 20 years. But I'm still a bumpkin. I feel there's such an association with the black experience in America and cities and urban environments. The reality is we're all country people. Most of us live in the South, and a lot of us are living in exurbs or rural places. So the film is an opportunity for me to explore that lifestyle and that way of being and show a different side to the black experience and our identity. One that I think is central to our experience as Americans." Tyrone and Nikki are compelling narrators for the story. Why did you choose their stories to anchor the documentary? There's a way that you can approach storytelling when you are connected to land and to a place, you know, place-based storytelling. And I feel like that really comes through in the film. North Carolina is very much a character in the film. Our brilliant researcher, Nadine Natour, worked on the film RBG and a few other projects. She did the initial research and connected with the Sustainable Forestry and African American Land Retention, SFLR. She kind of found the families initially and began to make the connections and sort of build that trust it takes to really get to people who want to participate in a film like this. And then I can't remember exactly how we came across Tyrone Williams and 40 Acres, but they're kind of rock stars in the black landowner community. Why did you choose to show these intimate moments between families in a documentary about sustainable forestry? We set out to make a film about sustainable forestry, but it's not just going to connect with audiences in a way I think will hold their attention for 90 minutes. Maybe a two-minute film or a five-minute film that tells you the basic of what it is and how it works, sure. But if you want me to make a feature, it has to be something that can really hold people's attention and that people will care about. So we asked, what are the barriers to people being able to hold on to their land, and how does sustainable forestry help? One of them was succession planning and passing down to the next generation. That's Tyrone's family. That's what they represent. And another one was getting access to resources and barriers to financing. That was the Jeffries family. So we dug into those two issues. I just didn't want to tell a story that was about something that was being done to black people. I wanted to tell a story about our agency and what we do. And SFLR was clear that at the heart of all these challenges are the family relationship. A developer can't come in and pick the land off the family if the family's communicating and they agree this is what they want to do, right? So for me, the story was always about family dynamics and the personal and interpersonal relationships. And that's where the juice lies. And I will be unable to conclude this interview, the final little section of the interview with this director, because our music is upon us, and that means I must depart the studios and go about my lawful business. So John Federson for the Indie Week, North Carolina Reading Service, ncreadingservice.org, which will save this program for posterity in its podcast section after this broadcast. We'll say so long, and we'll be with you again next week with Indie Week.